Hello and welcome to Exiting the Cave Short Reads. Having completed a brief hiatus, we're now ready to resume our examination of Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy. In this episode, we're reading Book 3, Chapter 4. Philosophy revisits the question of honor, but this time, instead of its relation to the good, we examine it in relation to true happiness. Let's listen in and see what she has to say. Well, but official dignity clothes him to whom it comes with honor and reverence. Have then officials of state such power as to plant virtue in the minds of their possessors and drive out vice? Nay, they are rather wont to signalize iniquity than to chase it away, and hence arises our indignation that honors so often fall to the most iniquitous of men. Accordingly, Catullus calls Nonius an ulcer spot, though sitting on the curule chair. Dost not see what infamy high position brings upon the bad? Surely their unworthiness will be less conspicuous if their rank does not draw upon them the public notice. In thy own case, wouldst thou ever have been induced by all these perils to think of sharing office with Decoratus, since thou hast discerned in him the spirit of a rascally parasite and informer? No, we cannot deem men worthy of reverence on account of their office, whom we deem unworthy of the office itself. But didst thou see a man endued with wisdom, couldst thou suppose him not worthy of reverence, nor of that wisdom with which he was endued? No, certainly not. There is in virtue a dignity of her own, which she forthwith passes over to those to whom she is united. And since public honors cannot do this, it is clear that they do not possess the true beauty of dignity. And here this well deserves to be noticed, that if a man is the more scorned in proportion as he is despised by a greater number, high position not only fails to win reverence for the wicked, but even loads them the more with contempt by drawing more attention to them, but not without retribution. For the wicked pay back a return in kind to the dignities they put on by the pollution of their touch. Perhaps, too, another consideration may teach thee to confess that true reverence cannot come through these counterfeit dignities. It is this: if one who had been many times consul chanced to visit barbaric lands, would his office win him the reverence of the barbarians? And yet if reverence were the natural effect of dignities, they would not forego their proper function in any part of the world, even as fire never anywhere fails to give forth heat. But since this effect is not due to their own efficacy, but is attached to them by the mistaken opinion of mankind, they disappear straight away when they are set before those who do not esteem them dignities. Thus the case stands with foreign peoples. But does their repute last forever, even in the land of their origin? Why, the prefecture, which was once a great power, is now an empty name, a burden merely on the senator's fortune. The commissioner of the corn supply was once a personage. Now, what is more contemptible than this office? For as we said just now, that which hath no true comeliness of its own now receives, now loses, luster at the caprice of those who have to do with it. So then, if dignities cannot win men reverence, if they are actually sullied by the contamination of the wicked, if they lose their splendor through time's changes, if they come into contempt merely for lack of public estimation, what precious beauty have they in themselves, much less to give to others? Though royal purple soothes his pride, and snowy pearls his neck adorn, Nero in all his riot lives the mark of universal scorn. Yet he on reverend heads conferred the inglorious honors of the state. Shall we then deem them truly blessed, whom such preferment hath made great? Lady Philosophy now asks us to consider the true nature of the pursuit of honor in lieu of true happiness. In particular, the honor conferred on those who assume the dignity or respect of a public office appointed to them by a ruler. She tells us that, like wealth, honor is a good which is not only insufficient as a good, but if one's goal is true happiness, then it is also counterproductive to that end. Her case for this begins with Aristotelian virtue, and relies once again on the argument from self-sufficiency. According to Aristotle, virtue is something that, once gained, is inalienable. In other words, once you are conditioned to a certain way of acting in the world, you will generally always act in such a way. It is similar to the process of learning to ride a bike. Once you learn it, you never forget it. Even if you go years without riding one, you will still be able to mount one and make it down the street fairly competently without having to relearn the habit. Likewise with the virtues. This is self-sufficiency, or at least evidence of self-sufficiency of the virtues. That inalienable self-sufficiency confers an inalienable dignity on the bearer. Men are admired for their innate virtues. But men are also admired for the station they achieve in political society. For example, being elected to the office of the President of the United States. To a certain extent, no matter how depraved the man, the dignity of such a high office will itself clothe the man who occupies it. The occupier will enjoy a dignity that he would not have been capable of on his own, and will largely leave him when he leaves the office. This is an important point for the argument, because it shows the insufficiency of official dignity to the pursuit of the true good, and as such, to true happiness. Being alienable, whatever the dignity of the high office is, it cannot be a good in the truest sense of the term, the sense in which philosophy means it here, because as we have seen in previous discussions, that which is inalienable from the person is not essential to him, and that which is not essential to him cannot be essential to his happiness. Philosophy doesn't stop here, however. She argues that, in appropriating the respect of high office, the depraved man actually diminishes the dignity it has to offer by way of exchange. One way to think about this is again to consider the office of the President of the United States. Whatever our political opinion of the particular policies of any given president, surely we can all admit that the reverence due to the office has greatly diminished between the time of George Washington or James Madison and Bill Clinton or Donald Trump. What's more, it seems by most examples that the sufficient portion of the respect of the office flows from the man rather than to him. Take, for example, Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt. To put the problem in modern prosaic terms, clearly Abraham Lincoln is significantly more presidential than Bill Clinton. Yet both became nothing more than remembered men once they left office. Only one of them fondly, I might add. There is an interesting but subtle distinction to be made here between what Boethius is actually talking about regarding the dignity of political office and the modern problem I have been alluding to so far in my examples of presidential authority. Namely, who is doing the conferring of this dignity? In our time, the authority and any reverence or respect conferred to the President of the United States flows upward from the consent of the governed, as Jefferson would have put it. People who pursue the respect and dignity of political authority do it by appealing to crowds of prospective subjects. We don't know yet whether the next president deserves our respect or not, because he is yet to take the office and perform his duties. His job as a candidate is to convince us to take the risk of putting him in that position. In Boethius's time, however, the plebiscite office holder was a mere distant cultural memory. By the end of Augustus's reign, in the year 14 AD, democratic power had largely been replaced by imperial authority. The dignity of the office and the respect of authority, then, was almost entirely a matter of maintaining the good opinions of your fellow imperial office holders and the favor of the emperor himself. Thus, we are once again reminded of the injustice of Boethius's present situation, or at least reminded of Boethius's despair at his perceived injustice. We can infer his lingering resentment from the poem Lady Philosophy offers to conclude this chapter. Surely the kind of dignity or honor that could be conferred in offices granted by the likes of Nero would not be the kind that any good man would ever seek, and could not be the kind that led to true happiness. Next, we'll move on to the allure of power itself. If conferments from men like Nero are insufficient, what about the placement of a good man directly in Nero's seat? Tune in next week to find out what philosophy has to say about the love of power.